Why are they shaking their head? We're stuck in slow life. Is it the beating of the chest that makes us feel the rest?
Good day, everyone. This is Marge Twisdale, producer and host of Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, and I'd like to welcome you to my interview with Edward Struzik. Edward, how you doing?
I'm doing just fine, thanks.
Folks, Prose, Poetry, and Purpose is recorded in the studios of Voice of Vashon on 101.9 FM KVSH. Learn more about the show at marchtwisdale.com. Alrighty, so Edward, let's go ahead and get started with you grounding our audience in who you are, what you do.
Well, I'm a fellow of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Policy at Queen's University in Canada, and I'm a contributing writer to Yale Environment 360, which is published out of Yale University. And I write about global environmental issues that matter to most people, and I explore ways of us adapting to the new environmental paradigm that's emerging out there.
Right. I think earlier during our pre-chat, you made sort of a comment like there is no normal anymore.
No, there hasn't been a normal for a long time, and we're seeing a new normal kind of unfolding, but it's unclear what the end game is going to be. And so that's, I think, the most interesting part of my job is trying to figure out how we're going to get from here to wherever we're going to be down the road.
Mm-hmm. Right. What actionable options do we have?
Yeah.
Okay. So folks, let's see real quickly, Edward, if people wanted to connect with you, ask questions, or check out some of your other writing, do you have a personal website?
I don't have a personal website, but I do. There's a collection of many of my articles on Yale Environment 360. That's all you need to type in and type in my name, and you'll see what I've written there for the past 5 or 6 years. And then you can look up Island Press, my last two in Washington, D.C. That's my publisher. My last two books were published by Island Press, and they have a pretty good biography of me.
Some of your books, there's the most recent one that I'm looking at that's in my hands right now. Thank you very much for sending this out to me, is called Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. As everybody knows, 2017 was a brutal fire year in the Pacific Northwest and the Pacific Coast. California's tragedies are still shocking many of us. This was super, super relevant. The previous book was Future Arctic, and the one before that was The Big Thaw. So both of those deal with the Arctic, correct?
They did, yes.
Okay, and then you have Ten Rivers, which is all about canoeing, which is like a really fun topic. And then Northwest Passage, you said, was a textbook?
It's a history book. It's really a 500-year history of the search for a Northwest Passage through the Arctic. And
Okay. Got it. That's the idea of, can we get from here to Europe through the Arctic?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
My writing.
People really tried to do that for a long time before they like gave up.
That's right. I mean, it was 500-year search, and I think more than 100 ships failed to make it. It was probably one of the most expensive searches in history. And by the time they did find it in 1905, a route through it, it really didn't matter anymore because they realized that there was just so much ice that it couldn't become a commercial waterway, although that's changing quickly now.
I was just going to say, so hold on, because it sounds like what was blocking access has now ceased to be. I mean, currently right now, basically every summer we have a Northwest Passage, don't we?
Pretty much. Yeah. It's navigable, but it's still very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
I think the problem right now is that we don't have any ports or roads, or really we don't even have very good navigational charts to lead ships through there. So there is an accident with one of these ships, it would be, I think it would make the Exxon Valdez oil spill look like a minor event.
Right. Not that we really want to be encouraging us to go and bring our lovely human noise to one of the last places on the planet that has thus far lived without human engagement. I mean, every living creature up there under the ice is pretty much free from our intrusion.
Largely, yeah, it is one of the last wild places in the world.
I'm aware that there has been, by the current administration, a real shutdown on, I believe, the EPA, and a lot of scientists are feeling like they're being blocked from communicating what they are learning. For you, given your fellow and the different work you have in this realm, what is your thinking about what's going on the political level right now?
Well, I think you summed it up quite nicely, is that there really is an assault on science right now. And I think it's very dangerous because I think science can provide us with a roadmap to the future. How do we get from here to where we want to be down the road? We're not going to be able to do that without understanding the scientific mechanisms that are involved in fighting fires, involved in predicting the movement of fires, and what the future is going to look like.
So this is perfect segue, because human beings engage in two ways with the forest. We do so in an accidental, unaware way, and then we do so in an intentional way. And you had mentioned earlier, like, there was a big burn in 1910, I think you said, and that the Forest Service, both in Canada and the US, made some decisions based upon that on how to engage with the forest. You also mentioned the effects of logging on the forest. On one hand, I want to say, let's go back. So I want you to take us back a little bit and explain some of the mistakes that got us here. And then the other piece is that if we're going to correct for those mistakes and handle things better in this uncertain future, it's going to take investment, dollars, thoughts, minds, and energy to come up with new and better ideas. But how about you first tell our listeners what it was that sort of made things worse over the past century?
When it all started is when we started settling the American West, and we started logging, building settlements in forested communities. And we at the time we didn't have the resources to be able to fight fires. So there are a number of huge fires that had a catastrophic impact on that human settlement. And probably the most notable was the Big Burn of 1910, a fire that burned pretty much all summer long along the Idaho, Montana, British Columbia, Alberta border. It was a monster fire. And following that fire, the army was brought in, towns burned down, people died. And following that fire, the U.S. Forest Service decided on a policy to fight every fire that burned in the forest. And then the Canadians did the same thing shortly after. So what happened over time was that we didn't allow nature to take its course in the forested world. So if there was a lightning strike, we went in and we put out those fires. What I think was missing at the time was that fires are essential to rejuvenating forests. Young forests are much more resilient to wildfire, and old forests are much more vulnerable. And so what we did over an 80, 90, 100-year period was we created a very vulnerable forest, and we didn't allow Mother Nature to take its to play its role in rejuvenating these forests that become vulnerable not only to wildfire but to disease and to insects. And so,
Let me jump in there for a second. You talked about there's these, you mentioned insects earlier. There's some sort of a beetle plague that's been attacking a bunch of trees over the past couple of decades. What is that beetle?
it's the mountain pine beetle in your part of the world, in pretty much Northwest Pacific. It's traveling now east into Montana and Alberta, moving into Saskatchewan. It's like a slow-moving freight train that is decimating forests. There are just tens of millions of trees that have died,
Right.
and
And
it's
yeah. So you're suggesting that It's sort of like when we do monoculture in our agriculture, plow a field, plant only one type of crop, then you are inviting whatever insect it is that eats that crop to really have a massive population boom because there's so much food and they can hang out all together and have lots of sex and lots of babies. Oops, I don't think I can say that. Oh, I can say it. Have lots of sex, lots of babies, and the next thing you know, you've got this explosion of a particular pest because of monoculture. So, in a way, by not allowing the forest to burn and by just maintaining them, we created an excessive amount of food for certain pests, which are now taking advantage of that opportunity.
That's right. And those pests are killing tens of millions of trees. And basically, that's just firewood for lightning or, an arsonist or people who start a fire accidentally.
Right. Oh, and so, okay. So we had some past policy decisions. And then along the way, as you said earlier, loggers would come in and say, hey, let us help out. How did that play out?
Well, there's a. What's happened is when a forest burns, typically the loggers come in and say, we'll salvage what's left out there. And for a long time, we really didn't know what the environmental impact of that was. And it's becoming increasingly clear that this salvaging can actually suppress the rejuvenation, the natural rejuvenation of that forest. And alter the landscape in ways that are not as positive as they would be if you just allowed, the fire to burn and a forest to rejuvenate on its own.
Do you mean sort of like in order to access the trees, they have to create roads and they cause erosion potential? Is it things like that, plus all the, excess soil that maybe flows into the rivers and damages the, fisheries? Is that what you're talking about, or is there something else going on?
No, that's one of the things is that when you go in and you clear out a forest, you make that area much more vulnerable to erosion. And if you have heavy rainfalls, all of that the carbon, the particulates, the chemicals that emerged out of that burn will wash up into a river and go downstream. And the town of Denver and good part of Colorado experienced this in 2002 when the Hayman fire burned. It wasn't so much the logging in that case, but it burned the forest so cleanly that it resulted in a huge erosion problem, and it nearly knocked out the water treatment plants that served 75% of the population of Colorado.
Wow. Right. All right. Okay. So, what about logging? And I'm not anti-logging. I just have to put that out there. But I'm just exploring this aspect. What about logging efforts where they say, we're going to go into this forested area, we're going to that has not burned yet. We're going to thin out the dead wood. We're going to basically make it healthier, and then it'll be less vulnerable to fires. What's going on with that?
Well, that's a really interesting question because the debate is ongoing there. Is that what do you do with all of this dead wood? And I think a case can be made that, yeah, you can harvest it. But if you clear cut it, then you produce the same kind of situation you have in any in a normal clear cut environment. Is that number one, you drive out all of those species such as spotted owls and caribou and many other animals that are dependent on an old growth forest. You also compact, the logging companies compact the soil and, can enhance erosion in these cases. And so this rejuvenation of the forest can become very difficult. Properly done, I think to some extent, that in areas that are very, very hard hit by these beetle infestations, there may be no other choice. And maybe in this case, we can also exploit that to create barriers around communities that are vulnerable to fire. So there's an awful lot of forest. If you clear the trees, that to some extent, allows firefighters to anchor in to prevent the fire from getting to town. It also evidence, you know, that makes it less likely that embers from a fire will get swept in and start fires within town. So, you know, that's one example where probably logging would be beneficial.
Okay. So now this book, here's what I like about this book, folks. You know, there's a lot of books out there, and sometimes you just look at the front cover, you look at the topic, you're like, oh, I'm interested in the topic. It must be a great book. But we all know that some books are like really, really dense reads, or they're just sort of hard to stay focused with, or they feel overwhelming, like there's, 29 chapters or something like that. What I like about this book is that there are 10 chapters, and it feels very doable. And I love your headings. Each heading makes it pretty clear what I'm going to get out of it, and I like the way you write. It doesn't come across too much like a textbook. You've got some first person stories in there, and there's images, quotes. So this is a very accessible book for anyone who's curious to learn more. And I think all of us should want to learn more about this subject right now, because wherever we live, fire is an issue that we're going to face going forward. I'm here on Vashon Island, very close to one of the wettest areas of the continental US. In fact, Forks, Washington, I think, gets more rain than anywhere, as we all know from the Twilight series. So, and yet, over the last 3 summers, and many of you will remember it if you're local, but if you're not, this gives you a sense of what's going on over here. It used to be normal to have rain during the summer once or twice a week through the whole summer. In fact, as a gardener farmer, I would water my entire garden maybe 6 times a year. That was about it. 3 years ago, we had 90, more than over 90 days in a row with zero rain. 2 to 3 times a week, 90 days of nothing. Pretty extreme difference, and the media was all over it. But then the next summer, same thing happened. I think we hit like 80 some odd days in a row of no rain. And the media ignored it. It was as if it wasn't worth talking about anymore. And what I found interesting was a lot of people would say, oh, it's such a lovely summer. It's so beautiful. And I remember at the end of that second summer, I finally snapped at someone, and I feel bad about it still, because she turned to me in like, early September and said, it's been such a lovely summer. Isn't this great weather? And I said, no, this is not good weather. This is terrible. I don't even walk in the forest anymore because everything's dying. It feels awful. This is bad weather. So, Ed, you and I were talking earlier about cedar shake, how far these little embers can fly through the sky, land, and cause damage, and what does the smoke do to us, the chemicals in wildfire smoke, and things that local communities can do to protect themselves against air quality problems, so let's go into that direction. Tell us a little bit about what type of roof people should not be putting on their houses.
Cedar shake shingles, for one. I mean, they're highly combustible. As everyone knows, cedar's a great way to start a campfire. And if you have it on your roof, fire can be 5 miles away. But if it's really windy, the embers from that fire can travel 5 miles. And if it gets on your roof, it can start a fire. If your house is made of wood, your house is gone, and perhaps your neighbor's house is gone. Similarly, if you've got cedars or junipers growing right up next to your house and you've gone through a hot, dry summer like you had in 2015 and 2017, those trees are vulnerable to fire. If you got mulch on your property, look at that as just, the fuse to light a stick of dynamite, because if the embers get into the mulch and the mulch is extremely dry, it will just lead right up to your wood house and burn it. So, there's a landscaping issue, there's a building code issues. There are a number of things that people can do to make themselves resilient to the impact of fire on their property. But I think, the other one is that, fire produces smoke, and we know that smoke from wildfires have pretty much all the same harmful chemicals that you find in tobacco smoke. And I think one of the things that I find rather alarming is that public health officials suggests that short-term exposure to this smoke is not really going to have a serious impact on your health. And I just don't know where that comes from, because I've never seen any study that has been done to suggest that smoke from wildfires is any safer than smoke from tobacco.
You know where I think it probably comes from? Is that generally public health will discourage the public from being worried about something if public health does not have a ready solution to the problem.
I think that's exactly the explanation for why they say that.
Yep.
But, if you take the precautionary approach, then, you do as I think public health officials doing now, is that they warn people, with asthma, the elderly, with respiratory problems, to stay indoors, shut your windows, don't go outside and try to, go for a long, vigorous walk. That's one solution, but I think probably a better solution for the really vulnerable people is that we have to have these safe havens, these refuges for people, community centers which have air purifiers, places where people can go, very vulnerable people can go in the summertime when you have that thick smoke that migrates from a wildfire. And we know that smoke can come a long distance. The fires that were, that were happening in British Columbia this summer, I'm sure traveled all the way down to the Seattle area.
Oh, no, absolutely. The first smoke that hit was coming down from British Columbia. Then we had smoke that actually was coming up from Oregon. Then we had smoke that was coming over from Eastern Washington. Like I said, I think we had about 3 weeks that were smoke-free this summer. And otherwise, it was almost 3.5 to 4 months of some level of smoke and many weeks in a row of very intense smoke. I do not have asthma. I did not have breathing difficulties related to that. I don't smoke anything at all, so my lungs are really healthy. But I began to feel a sense of claustrophobia in a way, there was a sense of wrongness. It was like this subliminal level that I could recognize and name as a panic that I was not allowing to take over. There was that much of a sense of wrongness, and I was intentionally not allowing it to grow. And that's me breathing fine, and there were so many people that I knew. What are you going to do? Oh, stay in your house with the windows closed for 3.5 months. Like you say, safe places where the air is clean, where a person can go, be productive, buy coffee, see their friends, use the internet. I think that was a great idea. And in a way, people might be resistant to the idea because it means that we're accepting that this is a serious and real part of our future life, but better to accept it and prepare than be in denial.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there's no question. It wasn't just by accident that, you had big fires in your part of the world in 2015 and 2017. I think this is a trend that you're going to be seeing more and more often. And it doesn't necessarily take 80 or 90 days of drought for a fire to ignite. Firefighters and fire scientists will tell you that, sometimes it takes only 10 days in 80 or 85 degree temperatures for a forest to be primed for a wildfire. Mm-hmm. And we just have so much forest, and we have so many people now playing, working, and living in the forest that the odds of more fires occurring just keep going up and up and up and up. So I think the new normal is that we are going to see more of these fires.
Right, right. So we have more vulnerable forests, and we have a growing population, which increases the already existent chance that human causes can happen. And then, of course, lightning happens anyways. So now you meant, like, for example, I want to talk a little bit about Vashon Island. So we have really wonderful people doing the best they can to be our fire service here. And they're really good at what they do when they can get access to a house. But we have a number of situations that will come up where a house will burn down because they couldn't even get nearby. We've got all these houses on these funky little roads and these weird little gullies or whatever. And I keep thinking, if a fire were to take off somewhere on Vashon, would it spread? And then you had pictures. I remember pictures of what was going on in California, Santa Rosa in particular, where you would have these huge areas where most of the houses, all of them were completely gone. And then, like, popping up here or there would be houses that were like untouched next to decimated homes. So there's obviously some interesting science that goes into how fire travels. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it all depends on what kind of fuel you have on the ground. Fortunately, in the Pacific Northwest, you do have a foggy landscape and you do have trees that I think are a lot more resilient to burning than the forests that you have that grow in, say, Idaho, Montana, British Columbia, and Alberta, which is a boreal forest. I mean, those forests were born to burn. That said, is that if it gets dry enough and you don't get the rain, it doesn't take a lot to ignite a fire. And the thing that we're seeing now, really worldwide, this isn't just a North American problem, it's a global
No.
issue, is that as the climate heats up, and it has been heating up pretty dramatically, you're also getting stronger winds. And if we have winds like we had in California this past summer, there's really nothing firefighters can do to stop those fires. And you can have all the water bombers you available, but really the best that they can do is maybe steer the fire in a different direction. So I think what we've got to do is have contingency plans in place, is like they do in Australia, which learned, after so many devastating fires, is that if a fire occurs, you've got to let hospitals and schools and government workers know where do you go in the event of fire, and when do you evacuate. Most cities in North America don't have plans like that in place. We kind of wait to the last minute. And in the case of Fort McMurray, which burned in 2016, there was 88,000 people, racing through a fire in the middle of the night trying to get out of town. And they were all so lucky to get out of there alive.
Right. It's so interesting when you look at generations. I'm 45, and people in my generation and above, they have a sense of, the television's going to go beep, in this emergency broadcast system. I mean, a lot of us grew up hearing those little practice experiments they would do on the television. So maybe that's what we think, is that there's a high-level group that's watching what's going on, and if something bad's happening, they'll alert us, and then we get to respond. We get to be told what to do. But what happened in California was that when the fire was moving so quickly and going across roads, it was wiping out a lot of the telephone lines and, internet lines and all that. And so my friends who were up near the Ukiah area, they had friends that were in areas where there was zero connection. You couldn't get information from anywhere, a small town. And they were woken up in the middle of the night by some dogs barking, and the fire was like 8 feet away from the house moving down the hill. No one knew it was coming because no one could be reached. And people had to jump out of their houses, get in their cars, honking, banging on doors. And within about 15 minutes, something like 23 houses in the small community had been self-evacuated. People literally couldn't pick up a single object. Robe in hand, run out door, flee for your life. So I think local resiliency is definitely a major theme of the future ahead of us.
It sure is. And there's a strategy that's called stay and defend. And I don't necessarily agree with it, but there are some positives to it, is that in the event that you can't, or you don't know where to go or what to do, people who live in these forested worlds should be able to know what they'd have to do to stay and defend their house and themselves. And this goes back to the building codes and also trying to figure out where do you go in your property area to escape, getting killed by that fire. Most of us are just not very well educated. And so when the fire burns, we're all running around with our hands up in the air trying to figure out Here I go, where do I go?
Right.
It's chaotic. And I think that, it has to be incumbent on, counties and on, state governments to try to educate people about what to do when a fire occurs. We've got to have kind of a plan in place, call it a code red plan, but something which will instruct people what to do if there is a fire threatening their homes or their community.
Yes, individuals saying, "Hey, does anybody else have a plan? What are you going to do?" Like, imagine if tomorrow everyone who listened to this show went to their favorite coffee shop in the morning on the way to work or whatever, went to their office and said, "Hey, I'm wondering if there was a huge fire, on that street in this neighborhood, what's your family's plan for dealing with it? How are you going to respond? Where are you going to go?" If everyone asked that question, I bet 95% of people would get an answer of, "I'm not sure.
Yeah, they don't, most people don't think about it.
I don't know what I would do." Everywhere I would drive, I'd be driving through forested lanes surrounded by trees in almost every direction.
And people also forget the grass burns, pretty nicely if it gets dry enough. So,
Yeah.
there'd be a lot of grass in between the forest and the house, but if the grass is really dry, that's not going to stop the fire from getting to where you are.
Well, if I felt it was far enough away from the trees, my thinking on that would actually be to do what the people did in the Bushmen of Kalahari Desert, where you actually light the grass on fire and you get it to burn, and then you step into the center area that's already burned because now there's no more fuel there.
Yes, that's one of the philosophies of or the strategies of firefighters is, one foot in the black, they say, because the black is unlikely to burn over again. But
Right.
these are things that fire can move very, very quickly, and most of us don't have the wherewithal to, think about these things. And do you have a place where you think you can light a fire? Do you have the matches in place? It's not easy to light a fire in many cases, but once it gets going, it's not easy to stop it. So these are all the kind of things that everybody I think has to think about. There's several programs in place, one called FireWise, another one called FireSmart, and these are national programs which help communities and homeowners adapt to the possibility of fire. Tell them what to do to make yourself more resilient to fire. And I urge people to look that up because they've got some really good advice.
So let's repeat the name of those two groups again.
FireWise, I think when you're part of the world would be the program to look at. It's an excellent program. They really, really think through what a communities need to do to become more resilient to fire.
Right. We have a lot of disaster preparedness on Vashon Island, which is focused on the fact that when the big one, the earthquake, comes or some major disaster, when you look at all the local state emergency response groups, we're like 3 weeks down on their list of get to, right? So everyone's like focused on this, idea that we will lose all of our resources, the trucks aren't going to show up with food, there won't be electricity. How do we survive for 3 weeks? But I haven't actually ever heard anyone say, how do we respond to a moving active fire? So I'm actually going to check in with our Vashon Be Prepared and other groups and find out if they do have already a fire plan in place, in which case, folks, I will go ahead and link to that as well. And when you go to marchtwisdale.com, Ed, is there one final thing, one gem you want to throw out there for folks with regard to how we live in the future world and relate to fire?
Yeah, I think that that it's becoming increasingly clear that we just can't fight all fires. There just aren't enough firefighters, water bombers, and helicopters and heavy equipment to go around. And as 2015 and 17 showed, triaging has become the order of the day. I think what we've got to do is really learn to live with fires because that's a natural part of the landscape. We've got to treat them the same way that we do tornadoes and hurricanes. We don't try to stop them because we can't. And I think that we have to look at wildfire the same way, is that a big mega fire cannot be stopped. So we've got to find ways of adapting it and managing it in ways, which minimize the impact that it has on our lives.
That actually triggers a question for me. When people who are experts in this field look back on fires and evaluate what was done, the response to the fires. In general, do they find that the efforts substantially improved the outcome, or is there an element of we're running around doing a whole bunch and making ourselves feel good that we're responding, but perhaps the value of all of that response energy and effort is relatively minimal?
Well, you look at the Yellowstone fire of 1988. That made I think, the front page of the Los Angeles Times, I think, 33 times that summer. Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, weighed in on it. The Secretary of State weighed in on it, the Interior Secretary. They were all angry that the National Park Service let those fires burn beginning. And they said that they were never going to let that happen again. And most people thought, Yellowstone, an icon, of American natural history, was going to be destroyed. And now we know, very shortly after that the natural state returned, and it was healthier and much more resilient to fire. In fact, grizzly bears moved in on the fire-scarred landscape immediately and started feeding on the carrion. And then the following year, they started eating on the mushrooms and the berries that started growing up after that. And so they actually got healthier because of the fire. And so we know, that fighting every fire is really not helping nature become resilient.
And if we think about the amount of money spent on fighting a fire, and then we and the potential for the loss of life, and the people who, if they're volunteers, are taking time and energy out of their life to go and volunteer and not receive a paycheck, and we were to convert all of those resources to the recovery effort after the fire is over, and the rebuilding and restructuring and support for people who lost their homes. What do you think would, do you think that it's worth making the economic argument?
Sure, it is. I mean, right now, if we continue throwing, we're throwing so much money at fire, at fighting fires. I think it's risen to about $2 billion a year. That's taking money away from, conservation programs that and management programs in the forest and programs that support, the recovery of endangered species, and also in rebuilding communities that have been destroyed by fire. That cost, if we could prevent that from happening, and I think we can, it provides a lot more money, less money to come out of government to pay for the cost, to pay for FEMA and other government organizations, that it's going to be a lot easier on our taxes, and we could use it for other resources.
Yeah, imagine if the firefighting volunteers were trained in how to do public outreach and education volunteerism, and we had more people able to go out and help people evaluate the regions around their home and how can you remove these trees over here or change that so that your home is now more likely to survive a fire. So in a way, human beings have always sort of had to grapple with what makes us feel good. Yay, I'm responding. Whoa! And what is logically most effective, which sometimes is feels counterintuitive, but may still be the better option.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. So who in the scientific firefighting arena world is perhaps promoting that idea right now?
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
So who in the arena of firefighting science and effort and all of this stuff, who's out there promoting this idea that we do things differently? Where could a person go to learn more and find out who I can write a letter to or who can I donate to? Who are the people who are sort of like championing this better way of responding and approaching?
You can read my book and you can get a lot of ideas from that, but you can also consult the FireWise and FireSmart programs You can easily find those on the internet, and they, have a lot of advice and a lot of services that people can tap into.
I
I
think
think.
what I meant was in Canada, if a person wants to track the political movement of this idea and support and encourage their elected representatives to pay attention, who would they go to? Who's lobbying on this issue?
That's the problem. Very few. There are very few people who, or organizations out there, who are, working, trying to get government. There's the Institute for Catastrophic Loss that's based out of Toronto that's on top of that. And that's basically an insurance, organization, because the insurance industry is getting very, very concerned, quite naturally, about fires.
Well, yeah.
I mean, and they want the government to do something about it. Right now, the governments on both sides of the border just aren't listening. The strategy generally has been that it's a business as usual scenario, and as Tom Zimmerman, who used to head up many of the U.S. Forest Service and National Park Service fire management program, says, business as usual in this day and age is not going to be successful.
No, definitely not. All right, well, then maybe probably the most actionable thing people can take away from this, folks of you who are out there listening right now, is figure out wherever it is you live, talk to your friends and family over the holidays, whenever you're gathering with people who you love and care about throughout the year, and say, hey, do you have a fire plan? And do you have a local group in your town or neighborhood or county at the biggest level that is dealing with this issue? Have you talked to your local fire department and asked them, because that's a beautiful place to go. Local fire departments are going to know the uniqueness of their region. So they're all going to have totally different answers because it's based upon, oh, we live on the beach, so here's our concern or whatever it is. So folks, go out there, find out what people know locally, come up with your own plan, encourage your friends and family and coworkers to do the same, and I guess that might be a great place to start.
And they might even, look up the International Association of Wildland Fire. It's an organization that represents a lot of different interests. I think some valuable information can be gleaned there as well.
And what's the name of that place again, or group?
It's called the International Association of Wildland Fire, and the current president is Thomas Zimmerman, who headed up many of the top level wildfire management programs in the U.S. Forest Service and the U.S. National Park Service.
And he is the one who said that the idea of business as usual is not a successful one. Yeah. Okay, brilliant. So let's talk a little bit about the Arctic, because you wrote two books about that, Future Arctic and The Big Thaw. So I guess maybe my question is for you, do you have any messages of positivity or hope when it comes to the changes that are occurring dramatically and quickly in the Arctic region?
I mean, the old Arctic that we know, a land of ice, and permafrost and extremely cold weather and of polar bears, that Arctic is coming to an end, and a new Arctic is unfolding. And there's going to be a lot of casualties in the new Arctic. Polar bears may be one, especially at the southern end of their range. There are going to be many other species that are going to be vulnerable. But I think, that with any everything, when something new unfolds, that we're such a powerful human force on Earth that I think we can shape the future in many ways. And right now, we're just not doing that. We continue to manage the Arctic as we have, for the past half century, and that is similar to what, Tom Zimmerman said about wildfires, that business as usual is not going to be successful.
Right. Walruses in the Arctic eat these small little crustaceans that are down in the bottom of the on the sand, right? And they have often sat on floating pieces of ice which would make it easy for them to flop off and swim down because it's a relatively shallow ocean region up there. And that supposedly with the melting ice, they're now stuck sitting on these little spits of land, which then can be very far away from the food source. And I had always wondered, I mean, we have giant oil rigs everywhere. How hard would it be to create, sort of anchored floating rafts, out there that they could sit on so they could have better access to their food source or something like that. When I think of management, I think of something like that, and then I go, oh, that's probably a ridiculous idea, and someone's got a reason for why they would never do that. Is that a ridiculous idea?
I don't know. I think that, but it's, all of these things are worth considering and testing. And I think that's the problem right now is that many people have a lot of ideas of how to protect, how to, conserve walrus populations and polar bear populations. For example, with polar bears, there's some talk, of putting food out for them in the summertime when they can't go out onto the sea ice. And so sort of bridge that time where, they're in a starvation mode to get them through the summer so that they can go back hunting in winter. But we've never really tested any of these theories and or ideas and to determine whether or not they're worthwhile. And I think that's what we've got to start doing is let's gather all of these ideas that are out there, and there are many, and they're outlined in my book, Future Arctic, which is also published by Island Press. And let's test them. And there are a number of places that we can test them. Churchill, Manitoba, which is the polar bear capital of the world, has probably one of the most vulnerable polar bear populations. And they've done an extremely good job of managing that population up until now. But I think everyone agrees is that something new and radical has got to be done. Do you provide, supplementary food for them in the summertime? Do you haze them in ways, that are, very aggressive to keep them away from humans? There are any number of ideas. Do you, there's even some talk of relocating them to other places, which I think probably is not a good idea. But, do we really know enough about that to make a definitive dismissal of that idea? I think that's what really needs to be done is we got to start going out there and testing them. The other thing that we don't do is that the current administration, has opened up oil and gas development in the Arctic. But, there's still no way of separating oil from ice so that if you have an oil spill, it's just going to travel under the ice where it's going to have an impact on all of those ice edge species, including beluga whales, narwhal, polar bears, seals, Arctic cod, any number of different species. And so we, if we're going, I don't think that we should be drilling for oil and gas in the Arctic, but if we do, we've got to, find a way of prevent better ways of preventing oil spills from happening. And if they do happen, ways that where we, are more secure in our understanding of how to clean it up.
Or to basically to gain this great lesson that history has taught us, it is to always use the word when, not if we're talking about oil spills, and to make sure that we've solidly and firmly had the technology in place to deal with the problem before we risk creating the problem. So it's like in the past, people have said, well, we can't solve the problem now, but the people of the future, well, they'll figure it out. So if it happens, then that'll be their impetus to go find the solution then. And we know how that worked out with the Gulf oil spill, right? So I think until we can prove we're completely capable of managing all of these potential problems, which will come up, we should not create the potential for them to happen. But even so, even if we were to have that approach, any solution we want to explore, I think needs to be one that is a sustainable one. Meaning, let's take that idea I had about floating rafts feeding the polar bears, right? The first thought that comes to mind for me is how are you going to get a bunch of dead cows or whatever it is you want to feed to the polar bears up there to plunk on the ground for a bunch of polar bears for 3 to 4 months in the middle of summer? You're going to use fossil fuels to either fly or drive fossil fuel fed and raised domesticated animals up there. Or you're going to be using fossil fuels to get around as a hunter and hunting the local animals and then transporting them again with fossil fuels. So even if we chose to explore that and let's say it worked, it's a guaranteed stopgap measure because at some point the availability of fossil fuels is going to go away. And I really doubt that alternative fuels are going to sweep in and completely replace them. So it's like, what would be the point of doing that for maybe 8 years or 14 years just to have the program fail at that point because now we don't have the resource?
Well, I think maybe, you're absolutely right in what you say, but then the counter argument might be is that it might give us 8 to 14 years of figuring out some other ideas. Unless we start testing them, it doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be permanent. And I don't necessarily support the idea of supplemental feeding for polar bears. But unless you give it a try and figure out, is this practical? Is it possible? Then how do we know?
Right. And until we try it, we're not going to know the unintended consequences or, oh, whoops, we didn't realize that was going to happen. Or, hey, look, that's great. That goes even better than we thought. Experimentation is what you're sort of advocating for. We need to be intentionally trying things out.
We need some big ideas. The United States is a big idea nation. And if anybody can come up with solutions to some of these enormous problems that, the world is facing, it will come from the United States. And I think that we've got to empower our universities more, our government research institutions more, to come up with the answers that we need to solve some of these problems.
I think you're completely right. Yeah, absolutely. It's where we put our attention, right? We can focus on war or we can focus on solutions. Yeah. Where do we put our minds, our thoughts, and our dollars?
It's a fairly small investment. Science is not expensive. Maybe it is in the area of, investing in, cure for cancer, but some of these other problems, it doesn't take an awful lot of investment to figure out whether something is going to work or not. And I think that we've really underestimated the ability of our scientists to be able to solve a lot of our problems that we face in the natural world. We're very, confident that they can, find a cure for cancer. And so we spend an awful lot of money in that area. But for these other problems, it's almost like we've kind of dismissed it.
Yeah, I think ultimately it's because cancer is a major profit area. So
It's true.
if you come up with a cure for cancer, you've come up with a product you can sell to hundreds of millions of people who are guaranteed to get cancer. So you've got a huge population of customers, and now you've got this product that you can sell to them, and they're all going to need it or they're going to die. Yeah, I can totally get why that gets support. But something like this, the polar bears are not going to be paying money for us to help them out. So the question is fundamentally in the United States of America is, I think as people, we have to decide, do we want to let profit be the number one determinant of where we put our attention and our efforts and our energy, or do we want to move beyond that and into a whole different set of values?
I think we're doomed if we pursue profit in every case, because that's not the answer to creating a world, a sustainable world. It's not the answer to, people who want to go out and enjoy nature, who want to breathe clean air and drink, fresh water. There has to be an investment in these things that don't turn a dollar.
Yeah, absolutely. Ed, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
All right, folks, that's our show. My name is March Twisdale. You've been listening to my interview with Edward Struzik. I'm going to spell that this time. It's Struzik. You can go to marchtwisdale.com, of course. Check out his bio, listen to parts of the show you might have missed, or shared it forward with other people. I'd like to thank you for listening to Prose, Poetry, and Purpose, where my guests share how they hope to inspire positive change in the world, one reader and one listener at a time.
Ye come here, gather round the stage. The time has come for us to voice our rage against the ones who've trapped us in a cage to steal from us the value of our wage from underneath the vestiture of law. The lobbyists at Washington do gnaw at liberty, the bureaucrats guffaw. And until they are purged, we won't withdraw. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. Our nation was built upon the right of every person to improve their plight. The laws of this republic they rewrite, and now a few own everything in sight. They own it free of liability. They own that they are not like you and me. Their influence dictates legality. And until they are stopped, we are not free. We'll occupy the streets, we'll occupy the courts, we'll occupy the offices of you till you do the bidding of the many, not the few. You enforce your monopolies with guns while sacrificing our daughters and sons. But certain things belong to everyone. Your thievery has left the people none. So take heed of our notice to redress. We have little to lose, we must confess. Your empty words do leave us unimpressed. A growing number join us in protest. We occupy the street. We occupy the courts, we occupy the offices.